You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Before we get started today, I'd like to ask a favor. If you like the show, can you please rate us in iTunes, like us on Facebook, tweet about Write the Book, or retweet our tweets. A little bit of enthusiasm on social media goes a long way to helping other writers and readers find the show, which is what we're all about. So thank you so much for considering that. Today on Write the Book, you'll first hear a conversation with former and current Poets Laureate of Vermont, Sidney Lee and Char Dunyord, who have collaborated to edit an anthology of contemporary Vermont poetry called Roads Taken, conceived of by Dee Dee Cummings and published by Green Writers Press. Sidney Lee was Vermont's 2011 to 2015 Poet Laureate. He has published numerous books in multiple genres, among them Pursuit of a Wound, a finalist for the 2001 Pulitzer Prize in Poetry. He's the founder of New England Review and has been awarded Rockefeller, Fulbright, and Guggenheim Fellowships. He has taught at Dartmouth, Yale, Wesleyan, Vermont, and Middlebury Colleges, as well as Switzerland's Franklin College and Budapest's National Hungarian University. His stories, poems, essays, and criticism have appeared in The New Yorker, The Atlantic, The New Republic, The New York Times, Sports Illustrated, and many other periodicals, as well as in more than 50 anthologies. He lives in Newbury, Vermont, and he is active both in community literacy efforts and in environmental conservation. Char Dunyord, who will be the second person you'll hear me speak to today, is the Poet Laureate of Vermont and author of 5 books of poetry, most recently Interstate, The Double Truth, and Night Mowing. His book of essays and interviews with 7 senior American poets, Galway Connell, Ruth Stone, Lucille Clifton, Donald Hall, Robert Bly, Jack Gilbert, and Maxine Cumin, titled Sad Friends, Drowned Lovers, Stapled Songs, Conversations, and Reflections on 20th Century American Poets, was published by Marek Press in 2011. His poems and essays have appeared widely in such journals and anthologies as the Pushcart Prize and Best American Poetry, the Kenyon Review, the New England Review, the American Poetry Review, the New Ohio Review, Agni, the Harvard Review, the New York Times, Plowshares, and Salamagundi. He is the co-founder and former program director of the New England College MFA program in poetry and a trustee of the Ruth Stone Trust. For the past 19 years, he has taught English and creative writing at Providence College, where he is professor of English. He lives in Westminster, West Vermont, with his wife Liz. And then Dee Dee Cummings, who is the editor, managing editor and director of Green Writers Press. Her poetry has been published in Mademoiselle, Connotation Press, Blood Root Literary, and other magazines and online journals. Her poetry collection, To Look Out From, won the 2016 Homebound Publications Poetry Prize. Dee Dee and I are going to actually be talking about that collection in July, and I'm going to talk to her again, along with Nadine Budbill, about the latest and last work by David Budbill that was published by Green Writers Press. Dee Dee Cummings lives in Vermont with her family and runs the solar-powered home office for Green Writers Press. So, I first spoke with Sidney Lee and then with Char Dunyord in a separate phone conversation. When I talked to Sidney Lee, he spent much of our interview sitting outside in the woods, which was where he was able to get the best cell phone connection. So, as he reads his poem, Yellow House, you may hear a little wind blowing around him. Please do enjoy that as you picture him in this way, sitting literally on a stump in the woods, which seems like a really appropriate way for a poet laureate or a former poet laureate to be reading his poetry. Let's see. One victim of our poor phone connection was poor Dee Dee Cummings, whom Sid credited for the idea for this collection, but his voice cut out, and so you'll hear him begin by only mentioning the press, but Dee Dee was the person who came to him originally. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I'll be back before we get to Char Dunyord, just to remind you of what book we're talking about. Thank you for listening. I hope you enjoy the conversation.
Green Writers Press in Brattleboro approached me, asking me if I was interested in doing an anthology of Vermont poetry, and I said, in the abstract, yes. In the concrete, no. I had other thing was going on, and I had bad experience doing anthologies before anyway. So I said no. And she approached Chard independently before I got to know him very well, and asked the same question, and he said something very similar. And then when we got to know each other a little bit after his installation as a state poet, we said, well, what if we do it together? And not knowing really how enjoyable that would be, we thought of it, I think we both thought of it as a kind of a community service.
Right.
And then when we got into it, it became quite interesting. And then I and he both are very pleased and a little bit surprised at the consistency of excellent poetry from so many poets. We got 80 poets in that volume, and our what's our total state population under 700,000. So our criteria were A, that you had to have published at least one non-Vanity Press book of poetry, two, that you had to have at least 5 years of residence in Vermont or something much longer by way of, you know, seasonal residence like Robert Penn Warren, and, or you had to have been born in Vermont like Dan Chaffin or Norman Duby, who don't usually get associated with Vermont, but were born, I think, in Windsor and Barrie, respectively, or Bellows Falls and Barrie, respectively. So we really never butted heads. We agreed virtually on the two of the five poems that each poet sent to us, ended up with a book that I think is really good, and it's not because of us, it's because of the quality of the poetry.
Yeah, it's a beautiful book. Now, how did you acquire the poems? Did you request submissions, or did you go to the poets and say, we want your specific work?
No, we didn't ask for particular poems. We asked each of the poets on our list to send five poems from which we would pick two. The only people who have more than two poems are those, in all humility, like me and Chard and Louise Gluck and Ellen Bryan Voigt and so on, who have been poets laureate, who get three. We gave ourselves a little bit of a pat on the back in that respect. But no, there was no predetermination of which poems we wanted, except, of course, by those by way of those who had died by the time we got around to collecting the material.
Yeah, I loved seeing work in the book by David Budbill and Leland Kinsey. I suppose I was a little surprised to find that Robert Frost, but then he's had such an influence on all the poets that live in Vermont.
Right. Well, we just sort of thought that we would define contemporary as beginning with Frost. That's perhaps a little bit of an expansion of the term, but it seemed like a logical place to start. In the cases of David and Lee, the poems were submitted before their, to me, very unfortunate deaths. They both seemed to be in fairly good shape when they sent the poems. David, in a curious way, are a little bit prophetic of his demise, mm-hmm. Which is unsettling. But at all events, we managed to include them, and they knew they were included while they were still on the planet.
Yeah. So you identified the poets that you wanted to have in the collection. You didn't put out any sort of call for submissions or anything like that.
No, we didn't, although in some cases, you know, the trouble with an anthology like this is that you're gonna publish the darn thing, and you yourself will realize within a week of its publication, oh, God, why, how in the world did we overlook her, you know? And, in fact, that happened, you know, at the 10 minutes of 12 hour, and we got some in whom we had overlooked, strangely enough, stunningly strangely enough, a couple of them had been students of mine at Vermont College. So,
oh, no.
The more inexcusable. One advantage of this print-on-demand format is that you can quickly make revisions. There were some, in the first limited run, there were a number of typos, some format problems, and one or two admissions, including Reuben Jackson, who's a jazz DJ on PPR and has more than one book out, and we were able to include him in the imminent second edition. So it's too bad to have overlooked some people in the first instance. Fortunately, that's amendable.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I wonder how did you go about, so you ordered, I think you ordered the poets alphabetically, but as editors, did you struggle at all with the task of ordering their pieces?
You mean the individual poems or the appearance of the poets within the volume?
No, the individual, I think the poets are alphabetical, are they not?
Yes, they are.
Yeah, so then the poems themselves, did you sort of have to think about which one should come first, which one should come second, and how it juxtaposes with the next poet's work?
Yes, I mean, within reason. You know, Jody Gladding is an increasingly experimental kind of a poet, and off the top of my head, Kate Featherston, who I think precedes her, is... And I say this completely neutrally, or in fact maybe even honorifically, because I include myself in this term, is more conventional in her format and her approach. So it would have been hard somehow to have said, well, if we take the second of Kate's poems, it'll go better with the first of Jody's. They're just so completely different, both highly skilled in their own ways, but ones which are at opposite sort of poles of praxis.
Yeah, yeah. Now, early in the collection, you have right at the beginning of the collection, you have an editor's note. And I wanted to just quote, you quote Ezra Pound in that note. You say, these poems offer news, in Ezra Pound's words, that stays news, and they do so in a wide variety of forms and subjects. Can you talk a little bit more about the Pound quote and what you intended for that to mean for this collection?
Well, I suppose I can. You know, it's odd that we should have chosen that because, frankly, I rather despise Ezra Pound in every respect. A sidebar, my collected poet laureate columns are going to also be published by Greenwriters Press sometime next year.
Oh, cool.
And I chose the same... I chose the same title, News That Stays News. So he's handy, even though I find him despicable. I often his comments on poetry as opposed to his own poems, which in most cases strike me as complicated as opposed to complex, and sometimes downright nasty, of course. A lot of his commentary on poetry makes a great deal of sense to me, and News That Stays News, you know, I find myself in the current political atmosphere increasingly drawn to writing sort of ad hoc, topical political poetry, which is entirely counter to my nature.
Yeah,
which,
it's not your normal style.
No, which suggests perhaps the profundity of the despair I feel in the current political situation. In general, I think poetry is news that stays news because we propose ourselves as poets an unattainable ideal, which is to find something, quote, universal, unquote, or, quote, timeless, unquote, and as opposed to topical. And I think it's that kind of sort of lasting as opposed to dated news that is implied by that quotation from Pound.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, great. You know, speaking of not liking Pound, it reminded me that in your introduction by Dan Chasson, he says some fairly negative things about New Hampshire, which surprised me.
Oh, yeah. Well, that doesn't surprise me. Vermont is always criticizing New Hampshire and vice versa. You know, it's strange that you cross the Connecticut River and a lot of attitudes towards the world seem to change almost abruptly, at least amongst the states empowered, put it that way.
Yeah.
So I'm not surprised that Dan actually has fled both of them and teaches at Wellesley, but at all events, I'm not surprised that a native Vermonter would, even though he was born, you know, in a place where, if not he, George Washington could have thrown a silver dollar into the other state across the river.
I guess I thought that with you being somebody who's sort of lived betwixt and between these two places, because you've lived in the Upper Valley, that
right.
maybe that would have been a little bit of hard for you, but I guess not.
Well, no, I always have, oddly, even for the, 30 years that I lived, or 25 years that I lived in New Hampshire, I always identified myself more with Vermont for whatever reason. I went there for my recreation and so on, and I often describe myself as having become a refugee from New Hampshire. I'm poking fun and overstating it. I heard Will Lang recently describe, people ask him, what's New Hampshire like? And he said, well, it's like Vermont, except without a sense of humor. And some woman in the audience from New Hampshire was deeply offended and came up and said, I take great offense at that. And he said, yeah, that's sort of what I'm talking about. Little Will, yeah.
Oh, that's funny. It would have been better if she'd just left, right? Oh, that's great. Okay, well, here, speaking of state reputations, I'm curious if you had to be careful at all with a subject like Vermont to avoid certain works that might become repetitive in theme or stereotype the state in some way.
I was frankly astonished, and maybe I hope that you and other readers would be too, going through the volume, how unrepetitive the poems seem to be.
Yeah.
I'm very glad that at the very last moment we were able to include Norman Doobie. I've always admired his work, and I knew him somewhat years and years ago when I was editing New England Review, because he would come to visit his father, who was then a pastor in New Hampshire, so I associated him with New Hampshire.
Right.
But his father, who was a bit of a William Sloan Coffin-type troublemaker as a clergyman, went back and forth between the two states. The reason I mention that is because there's a poem in there called Horatian, Half Moon in Vermont.
Yeah.
Which is just a sensational knockout poem with a terrific ending, and it undercuts any tinge of the kind of Vermont life romanticism attached to the idea of living in Vermont, and it shows a side of the state that you can discover, say, in my town by just walking over one ridge.
Right.
The little village is as quaint as Norman Rockwell could make it, but you don't have to go very far to see the sort of thing that he's describing.
Right.
I'm glad that I've had that included.
Yeah, that's a wonderful poem, and it's funny because the title sort of makes you think it's going to be very quaint. It's got the half moon. It's called Horatian Half Moon in Vermont. And then in the end, it's about poverty, and it's a wonderful poem. Yeah. I was going to ask you to read your poem, Yellow House, and we could talk about it, but I'm wondering if maybe you don't have it outside in the woods with you right now.
I've got it. Here we go. And it's apropos in one respect, which you'll divulge in after having read it. Yellow House. You had to know the combination, that's how you put it, how to tweak air volume controls on the antique pump, and from which roof valley you needed to chop the ice dam first, and how to get a stone dead broiler to kick in again, where to aim your propane torch at that same damn pipe just under the sink, in the kitchen that froze to death whenever it was 20 below, not to speak of lower. You couldn't get things too hot too fast. If you did, the whole cold mess would burst at the usual elbow, and you'd have to sweat another new joint, and the water that jetted before you could turn the valve would have turned to instant crackling ice on the floor. That old fake brick linoleum floor, no cellar below it. You're in for it now, but good for it too, because you were young, and welcome to challenge, no children yet to worry about. As you did about the round oak stove, all filigree and fluted finial, but its firebox only thin sheet metal, that glows so red you sat up to watch it, afraid for the house or your wife upstairs. One time there lay just moisture enough in the sand you shoveled to damp the blaze that the stove blew the mica right out of its door, cold scorching the boards. Still you survived, if the marriage didn't. Isn't it good to be out of that wreck? That old yellow house with its corn cob and paper for insulation, its biting boreal gales through every socket and nail hole, and you married again. After 25 years, it looks as though this thing has stuck. After this quarter century, you're in for good now. How strange, therefore, that you can almost think well of those days, when most of a winter meant such an adventure. It's better now, and your walk this morning in the deep blue glory of February, planet bright snow on every branch, and you're coming home to affection and warmth. You couldn't beat either with a stick of stone, as your long dead grandmother used to say. Back in a time when the drift got deeper, the air got colder, your children were only dreams of a future who are grown and gone.
Thank you.
That's the oldest poem I've offered in the book, because I've been married 35 years, not 25 years, so it's not a brand new poem.
I love that poem. I love the wind that is whipping behind you as you're reading that poem.
You should add for those who are really listening on the radio that I'm very quaintly sitting on a stump. That will add to the end.
I loved that. I mean, there are so many ways in which this poem takes sort of a memory of a difficult time and turns it into something nostalgic for past life. And one of the moments that I just love is you were in for it now. And then later, after this quarter century, you're in it for good now. And that was so wonderful.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
It's a poem that's written about my and my then wife's first house in New Hampshire. But there may be a little, in light of what we were talking about earlier, there may be something resonant in isn't it good to be out of that wreck? I don't know. I don't want to read too much into my own poem.
I love it. I think that's fantastic. Well, Sid, I really enjoyed speaking with you today. I really enjoy this new collection, Roads Taken, Contemporary Vermont Poetry, edited by Sidney Lee and Char de Noord, who I'm going to speak with in just a few minutes here. And thanks for coming out of your cabin into the woods to talk to me on your cell phone today.
Well, thank you. You're always such a good interviewer, and it's always a pleasure to talk to you personally. Thanks for calling.
You're listening to Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was the first half of an interview with Sidney Lee and Char de Noord about the new collection that co-edited Roads Taken, Contemporary Vermont Poetry, published by Green Writers Press. We're streaming on 99.3wbtv.org. And in the second half of the interview, you're going to hear my conversation with Char de Noord, who is our current Vermont Poet Laureate. I began by asking Char to talk about how he and Sidney Lee worked. What was each of their roles as editors?
You know, we just worked together, we collaborated, and I knew people that Sid didn't know and vice versa. And we put out the word and started soliciting poems, and we kept discovering people we had no idea who, you know, had lived in Vermont for extensive periods of time, and right up till actually the publication date and a little bit beyond. BD is in fact, in her revised second edition, putting about two or three more poets in than we had found initially.
Yeah.
So, you know, we established this criteria that was really probably the most difficult part of our job, because we didn't want to be, you know, elitist on the one hand, and yet we also wanted to set, you know, a pretty high standard. Since her poetry has such a rich, I mean, Vermont has such a rich poetry tradition.
Yes.
So we came up with I don't know if Sid mentioned this, the idea of, or the, just the requirement of at least one book by a publisher that wasn't a vanity press and a significant amount of time of residency in Vermont.
Mm-hmm. Did it have to be a book of poetry?
It had to be a book of poetry, yeah.
Yeah. Now, do you have any story of that comes to mind of interacting with the poets for this collection? Is there any story that you enjoy, anything that you enjoyed in dealing with some of these poets that you might share?
Well, I just would reiterate again that I really enjoyed working with Sid, who's lived in, you know, New England for so long, both New Hampshire and Vermont and now Maine, and just knows so many people. As you probably know, he read, I think, at every single library in Vermont when
yes.
he was poet laureate. It's one of his goals. But was also, you know, the editor of the New England Review and was really just the perfect person to do this project with. And is just, and, you know, a wonderful poet himself as well as a fiction writer and essayist. I couldn't have been luckier to have someone to work with. I just felt very lucky to have also to have been in touch with really some terrific poets before they passed away, who were in the anthology. It would have been in any way, but who we corresponded with, Stephen Sandy, Ruth Stone, a number of years beforehand, but had talked to her about this. Of course, Galway Cannell, Leland Kinsey, and David Budbill, are folks who come immediately to mind and who were just really happy that we were doing this and send in poems enthusiastically. And so that perhaps is the best memory that comes to mind.
Sure.
Foremost.
That's wonderful that you interacted with those people. I was very fond of David Budbill. I didn't know Ruth Stone or Leland Kinsey, but I wish I had gotten to know them.
Yeah.
And another poet that's in this collection is Grace Paley, who I never met. I regret that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm so happy she's in there. You know, she was a poet laureate and primarily a fiction writer, but also a poet. It was such a great thing for the Vermont Arts Council to choose her as a poet laureate. It was so deserving in many ways.
Well, let's talk about that role for just a minute. You are now Vermont's poet laureate, and I wondered if you can talk a little bit about what your goals are for fulfilling that role.
Well, I'm learning as I go, and I'm coming up with ideas that I bounce off of my friends, my poet friends, as well as just close friends and my wife to see what seems to make the most sense and most is original as well, something that may not have been done before. So this anthology was the first idea that I sort of came up with and thought would be important, fraught with, as you know, inevitable frustrations at times, and oversights that an editor can't avoid with something like this, like a project like this. You know, leaving someone out inevitably. It's an honorary position, so no one's telling me what to do, which is nice. Stone was the poet laureate and was bedridden and, you know, couldn't do anything, but it was great. She was a poet laureate, and if people read her work, that was really enough. But I feel lucky to be able to travel around the state and give readings at libraries and schools and be a kind of ambassador for poetry. And to, as I think I just mentioned to a reporter initially, to sort of demystify poetry in a way that makes it exciting and meaningful to everyone who reads and people who don't read, who just love to maybe hear poetry for the first time. To really do the best I can as far as carrying on this uniquely strong legacy of poetry in Vermont, where poets such as Robert Frost and Galway Cannell and Ruth Stone and Grace Paley and Ellen Bryan Voigt and Louise Gluck have all held this position and done their own thing with it.
Yeah. Now, is there a website people can go to see what upcoming events you have scheduled?
Yes, I've got to update it, but it's just my own personal website. I don't have Port Laureate. I just have www.chartdenort.com.
Okay, great.
That has events and readings. But I also other things that I've I've been doing and plan to do to sponsor a reading at Next Stage for those poets who haven't published a book yet, but who have published poetry and who write and who aren't in the anthology, so that we aren't appearing again as a kind of just an elitist anthology, but. Or I'm not appearing as an elitist, as an editor. So that'll happen on November 4th at Next Stage in Putney. I'm writing a monthly column for the newspapers in Vermont, the Valley News, and the Rutland Paper, and the Brattleboro Reformer as well, on some subject having to do with poetry. And working with the Youth Writers Project as much as I can. So these are just some things that I'm doing.
Yeah, okay.
I'm trying to write just continuing writing myself. That's really sort of at the top of my list. I don't say that selfishly, but if I'm not writing, I just am not a happy camper.
Yeah, and it must be really hard to have time to do everything, particularly now that this, it's a wonderful honor, but it's probably quite time-consuming.
Yeah, I teach full time. I'm a professor of English and creative writing at Providence College.
Oh, wow.
I commute down there twice a week, go down and back the same day, so that I can be in Vermont as much as possible.
Now, let's talk a little bit about Vermont as the subject of this collection of poetry. Editor's note at the beginning talks about its mystical landscape and fiercely self-reliant citizenry. I loved that. I thought that was a wonderful description. And I just wondered if there are any other aspects of the state's character that come to mind for you when you think about the poems that you received.
I think that sort of captures it for me.
Yeah.
It's increasingly diverse. If there's one thing Vermont is lacking, of course, it's a diverse citizenry. Not of course that many black folks in Vermont, and that's something that other poets such as David Budbill has written a lot about.
Yeah.
So I am certainly mindful of that and wish to do all I can to be as inclusive and Catholic with a small C in my taste.
Right.
That description, though, Vermont, of all the New England states, is perhaps sort of the most independent and fiercely self-reliant.
I mean,
it's the only, it's the last state to sort of hold out to, as a state in New England.
Yeah, the fact that we separated from the country at one point sort of represents that.
That's right. That's right. When they wanted Chittenden to be the president, really, of the Vermont as a country. Of course, it failed back in the late 18th century. But Vermonters, the first Vermonters moved up from Massachusetts primarily and were, just incredible in their work ethic and their ingenuity. They're more, I think, patents from Vermonters than any other state per capita for farm equipment and industrial equipment. The logging they did, 80% of Vermont was cleared at one point, was tillable for grazing land. And so to be able to clear that much land, to build that many stone walls, and to live, really, the first Vermonters lived inside of trees they hollowed out, they were almost animalistic in a way.
Wow. I don't think I know that history.
Yeah. And as far as its utopian communities, sort of newfound religions as a perfectionist that started in Putney, Vermont, and ended up in Oneida with John Humphrey Noyes. It's always been a kind of religious laboratory as well as this fiercely independent state where people just lived by their wits and strength and sort of brute will that is almost unparalleled. And And so that somehow has really come down into the poetry of Vermont, has filtered both culturally and physically in a way into the culture that has made it a unique state as far as its, as I said, so, you know, self-reliant legacy, legacy of self-reliance.
Yeah.
And Frost really was the first poet. There are others who've been overlooked. There's a fellow named Walter Hard, who was very famous, but was a kind of folk poet in the, you know, as in a way that was very popular during his lifetime. He was contemporary with Frost, but is forgotten now. But to read that the early poetry of Vermont, early 20th century poetry and some 19th century poetry, and the poetry of Frost in particular, that captures that. What is it? There's a kind of mystical realism, in a poem like Two Tramps in Mud Time, or Out, or it's just his poem New Hampshire, where he's looking out upon New Hampshire, but grateful that he's living in Vermont. that is unique, and I would say that, you know, it's fair for Vermont to claim him as their poet laureate and their poet, even though he lived I have to look this up, but just as much in New Hampshire as he lived in Vermont.
Right. And which poet are you talking about?
Oh, Robert Frost.
Oh, Frost. Okay. I heard you say William Hard. Is it Hard?
Oh, Walter Hard was another poet who was contemporary with Frost. And
okay.
Very, very popular, but his poetry hasn't endured on the page
right. In
the way that Frost has.
Yeah.
And after Frost died in 61, 62, whatever it was, he was the first poet laureate. And the next poet laureate wasn't appointed until 1988 or 9, and that was Galway Canal. So there was almost a 20-year period there before, Vermont didn't have a poet laureate. But I can say that every poet since Frost, Canal, Robert, the Galway Canal, and then Louise Gluck, and then Ellen Bryan Foyt, and then Grace Paley, and then Ruth Stone, and then Sid Lee, and then me have even though our poetry is very different, I think have reflected the spirit that I just mentioned in Vermont, and I can only hope that it continues.
Yeah, it's interesting. You know, the 20-year gap, it makes me feel like poets had a lot to learn from Frost, and filling his shoes took a little while.
that's right. Well, no one could have matched Frost. You know, I like to say that Vermont fell in his lap, and he was up to the task.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Chard, I was wondering if you wouldn't mind reading one of the poems of yours that's included in this collection. It's called To Hear and Hear, and then maybe we can discuss
sure.
it as we finish
sure.
up.
Sure. Yes, I'd be happy to.
Great.
This appears in my book, Night Mowing, that the University of Pittsburgh published in, 2005.
Okay, great.
This is To Hear and Hear. The hermit thrush is set for 6 to sing her song as if it were the end of the world and she was stirred by dusk to sing the same sweet song again and again in the understory, as if to say it's neither words nor meaning that matter in the end, but the quality of sound, as if we were deafened by the sun and needed her song as a key to unlock our ears, to hear and hear and understand, to see and see, knowing that this one day is the end for now, which it is. It is, she claims, with a song just loud enough to pierce the woods until the night descends like a thousand veils, and then just one.
Mm. Thank you so much for reading that. I love that poem.
Yeah.
I don't know
the hermit thrush.
Yeah, I don't know the sound of the hermit thrush. I have to look that song up on the
Oh, you should. You absolutely should. It's the most beautiful piping you've ever heard.
Yeah, and I was wondering if, so we should say to hear and understand, to see and see, and then later it is. Those are in italics. Are those attempting to imitate the sound of the bird?
Well, that's actually a biblical phrase, to hear and understand, to see and see.
Okay.
So I just lifted it out of the Bible, but that's, you know, that's why I put it in italics.
Oh, okay. Clearly I don't know my Bible very well.
That's okay. It's one of those paradoxical phrases from the New Testament where I think that Jesus is admonishing folks for hearing but not hearing. I'm emphasizing the importance of hearing here as a way of understanding,
and
perceiving rather than just hearing something.
Right,
and the same with seeing.
And you're moved to these thoughts by the song of the hermit thrush. I love that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
State bird, by the way.
Yeah. No, I know that's the state bird, and I need to listen to the song on the internet, I guess.
Well, when you're sitting out sitting out in your yard in the evening, they only pretty much sing at dusk. They're like little alarms for dusk, and you hear this piping. They're invisible. The bird, you can never find them because they're camouflaged and they're in the ground birds. But then just suddenly to hear this piping coming from the forest, it's magical.
It is, yeah. That sounds wonderful.
Yeah, yeah. So that's part of the mystical part of Vermont for me.
Absolutely. It's funny, this year I am noticing so many birds this year. It feels like the bird song has gone up 30% since last summer.
Yeah, I've noticed that too, yeah.
It's amazing. Yeah. Also the frogs. We have a pond and the frogs are going nuts. So.
Oh, the peepers. I've written about them too.
Yeah, yeah. That's wonderful. Well, Chard... Yeah. Chard de Njord, I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today about Roads Taken, Contemporary Vermont Poetry, published by Green Writers Press. I really appreciate your time, and it's a beautiful collection. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you, Sheila. It's an honor to talk to you.
You're listening to WBTV LP Burlington, Vermont, and you're listening to the Song of the Hermit Thrush. We're streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org, and soon we'll be broadcasting on your radio at 99.3 FM. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was a dual interview with Vermont's former and current Poets Laureate, Sidney Lee, and Chard de Njord. They collaborated on a new collection, Roads Taken, Contemporary Vermont Poetry, published by Green Writers Press. You can learn more about their work at their websites, sidneylee.net and charddenjord.com. And just to reiterate, I'm going to be speaking with Dee Dee Cummings a couple times in July, and you'll get to hear about her poetry as well as her work as founder and editor at Green Writers Press. This week's Write the Book prompt is to go outside and listen to the birds and write as you listen. The morning may be the best opportunity for this exercise, but if it's nighttime, then maybe you have a place you can go and listen to peepers or frogs. Or just your neighbors having dinner on the back porch. Listen to the sounds around you and write about them. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and please listen next week for another prompt or suggestion. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. So, for example, if you wanted to hear the show that I aired in the first hour today, that'll be up on the podcast site in the next couple days. You could listen again, share it with friends. That's available on iTunes or the podcast site. If you wanted to hear something more like what I played in the second hour, which was the interview with Shu Si from 2009, that would only be on the podcast site. iTunes makes available just sort of the most recent, 20 or so shows. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and Write the Book Radio Show on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. And then, of course, you can stream the show live each week at 99.3wbtv.org every Monday at 3. Stream the show live, and then when we're broadcasting, we will be on 99.3 FM, and we will be sure to let you know when that happens. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. And as I said at the beginning of the show, if you do like the show, it would be a great favor to us if you would please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, tweet about it, tell all your friends. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book on WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. Have a great week.